Okay, this is, we had an interruption. Myron had an interlocutor that interrupted his paper, and we had to get the security to remove the person. They really were protesting at the idea that Hitchens was a cool guy and that Zizek was a bad guy, you know. So
they were stuttering.
Yeah, they were stuttering like hell physically. So they were removed, and but we had to stop the recording, so we're starting part B of the fourth session in Myron's fourth paper, December 17th. Part two, and we'll pick right
fourth
up.
And a half paper, I think this is.
Yes, the second half of the paper we're working on. No, it's three and a half papers. We got half of the fourth. We got another half, and then we'll have four papers. We haven't finished the fourth paper.
I'll try to gather them.
Yes, okay, so we were right at the exciting point where you were getting worked up about discussing Hitchens. Oh, I was telling you about the panel.
Zizek and the stutterer.
Yeah, let me finish the panel story. So there's Zizek, all contorted.
This is about the panel at New School with Hitchens
in 98. And Steiner. And so this guy's all contorted, like he's very over-concerned about something and gesticulating ridiculously from a WASP. I'm Catholic also. But anyways, a white guy from the North America, English background, looking at this European gestural Italian kind of thing where the guy's very emoting. And I said, what is that? What a whack job. Well, when it came to his turn, then that whack job was on the panel. I couldn't believe that. And then when he got to perform, he continued this angst.
Yes.
And everybody was rather cool. Maybe they knew him. And everybody's listening to this guy. Just really worked up. And that's what I remember. And then a few years later, I started hearing about the Zizek guy, and then I see some of his books. That's that guy that whack job, you know, that like totally emotional guy.
Yeah.
And basically, he was all pent up, like he probably needed to have a public, and he didn't have one yet in 98, you know what I mean? And he thought he had something to say.
But he's still like that now, though.
Is he?
When
I saw him in 2000...
Even on his TV, that's just his normal way of speaking.
Oh, okay, because I saw him in 2007 or 8 at the New School in a public thing for his film, the biography film of him.
Zizek with the exclamation point.
Yeah, and he was a little more relaxed, I thought, there. But who knows? I haven't seen him all the time.
But even in this television show, that they're doing the Lacanian film analysis stuff.
Shoulders and emotive, gestural. Gesture recognition, that's the new thing. That's speech recognition. Gesture recognition.
The micro emotions and stuff.
Yeah, like the thing.
The criminal justice system is really going for that. There's that show, what is it?
Minority Report, where the guy's
No. I'm talking about reading gestures to see who's lying. They're doing that with computers now.
Okay, all right.
It's like that's like Web 3.0 almost. It's the counter...
Gesture recognition. Because they've showed these people...
Because it's micro-gestures. It's facial... So when you ask somebody, they'll train this really high-speed camera on somebody while they're getting interrogated, and they have the computer do this analysis because it's these micro... these nanosecond emotional things like tick, you'll like sneer when you're supposed to be smiling or you know things like that, or like when you're supposed to be finally recalling somebody, you know, you sneer, or like you know when you're talking about
it's your unconscious
somebody being
speak.
Missing, you know,
it's x-raying a kind of unconscious of your real psychological
it's really crazy because they take a snapshot of that microsecond and you look like a demon came out of you,
so that
people can't usually pick it up. There's a test they say about 5% of the population is really good at picking up on those, and I actually tend to score really high on that, on reading micro gestures and knowing who's lying and stuff.
Okay, so in Minority Report, remember Tom Cruise is moving his hands around and he's not touching. Well, this is what they showed yesterday in the news: a guy not touching and making gestures and making things happen on the screen. Is that what you mean? That's what they mean by gesture recognition. Is that you can make
no. What I mean is the micro gesture.
I know. Of the camera looking at you,
but of the person too.
But
see,
you have speech recognition. Now you have the computer can recognize your hand movements and respond to you.
Yeah, there's a game system. Well, the Wii started that really. It was with the Wii, Nintendo Wii.
Yeah.
That was with the controller sort of, and it was an infrared thing, and it knew where the controller was going and. There's an accelerometer,
but
I think, and a gyroscope.
But then
the Kinect came out a little later on. That was Microsoft's Xbox.
Right.
That was the response to the Wii.
I see. Yeah.
And that with that thing, you didn't need a controller.
You just made gestures.
There was just a camera.
Yep.
And that's what you do to this day. And now there's a whole thing. You can hack the Kinect. A lot of people have been doing, computer things where simulated virtual space is projected onto like a all around you screen. And 360 degrees, and then you can gesture, and the Kinect sensor camera is actually trained on you, and if you go like this, you know, something will get farther away. You can throw things, you know.
Okay, gesture recognition. When do you think that?
Do yoga.
Right. When do you think gesture recognition started? When did it show up on the scene? 10 years ago?
In its newest form, yeah.
What would be an older form?
Well, I'm thinking of an older form. The who was it that cybernetician?
Norbert Wiener?
No, it was the other one. It's a big one.
Well, Norbert Wiener was the starting of it, but a later one?
Yeah.
Ray Kurzweil?
No, a little earlier a bit. Well, whatever. The point is it was the anthropologist. I can't believe I'm forgetting his name now. But
what did he do?
He was talking about how gestures are sort of one step removed from the actual thing. So like a dog baring its teeth. Instead of biting, that's showing that he could bite, sort of thing.
Right.
And so gestures become the, you know, the
signalers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's your point about that?
Well, that's the beginning of gesture recognition in its earlier form.
Well, I'm talking about technology that can do gesture recognition.
Yeah. But I mean, technology is an extension of ourselves, so that's why I'm bringing.
You're saying that noticing a dog is just the theory that a dog is anticipating or telling you what it's going to do. You're calling that gesture recognition?
Sure.
That's just a psychological theory. It's a verbal thing. I'm talking
about
technology picking up.
It's really not. That's how you train. That's how a dog, like, it's behavioral, and that's how a dog is signaling without actually biting.
Right, so a dog does
and
that.
Humans do that too.
Right. Now that's what humans, that's biology. What about the
But it's also the recognition of that, otherwise there would be no point to it, because we recognize
the
overture
what you
to doing something.
What you mean is that the internet was first started by speech. Okay, that's what you're talking about, broad term of the definition here. The internet is just, was started when people started talking. I'm talking about technical virtual responding through a camera, whatever it is, that I saw on TV. When did that kind of technology, nothing with dogs, when did that start?
Probably 10, 15 years
okay.
ago.
Okay, all right. So I like that, gesture recognition.
But I mean, you have those moving lights and stuff, moving sensored lights and things
right.
like that.
You mean security stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or those robots that vacuum your floor that go about and they can sense when there's a wall.
I've never heard the term gesture recognition before until yesterday.
Yeah, that's...
And I like that term.
Yeah.
That's a new thing. We got speech recognition has been a talk for 15 years now. When did gesture recognition come into the computer world's jargon? Like, when did you first hear that term applied to new technologies?
I think when the game systems started to. Oh,
okay,
really,
so I don't play games.
But Minority Report really ushered. It was really
that was an example of gesture recognition.
Yeah,
okay.
And now they have something that's exactly like that. Microsoft just showed off one of their. It's a computer completely controlled by gesture and movement.
Okay, so there's an example where
holograms.
I don't play games or any of this digital stuff, so I didn't know about that. That's me finding out about a technology, an environment that's being built that I didn't know about or didn't know that term. So. You'll see me using that and developing patterns, even though I'm way behind on noticing it. But my patterns will be way ahead of everybody once I figure out what to say about it.
You better hurry up.
Yeah, you don't know so much. So back to Zizek. So I didn't finish the story. So Zizek does his scrunch soldiers emotive thing, and then Hitchens says his opinion, and they banded back and forth, all of them. It was a very good panel. And then, and I, in the question period, brought up McLuhan, as I always do. My agenda in New York was going around and inject McLuhan into everything, or a new kind of McLuhan, not what they're used to. So that Hitchens comes over after and says, what do you know about Harold Innes? And I said, well, I know a lot about him. And he says, I am doing research in Harold Innes. And he didn't say why, but I think he was going to take the Innes tack around the McLuhan fad. You know, McLuhan was becoming a moment of topicality because he got the patron saint of Wired.
Yeah.
So McLuhan was in the air. So he, being a contrarian, was going to go for the Innes angle.
Okay.
So he wanted to know how he could get Innes stuff. And I said, well, I could tell you. He says, well, how will we do this? And I said, well, he says, let me call you. So I gave him my number. And, you know, about a month later, I get a call from him. I wasn't home. He left a message trying to, he's now got back to me to find out what I could tell him about Innes. And, I called him back and left a message. He never called back. So he lost his interest in Innes pretty quickly. But that was interesting that that's as far as he got. He was interested in Innes in the media world.
Right.
In the McLuhan world. Then
now, Hitchens was a very pretty practical sort of fellow.
Oh, yeah. He's in the Rouge Quadrant in my chart. And he's concerned about the second world. Not the third world, the second world. The bureaucracy world, the Iraq. They, you know, George Galloway is concerned about those worlds. They take that view and was considered left, but then it became confused in the last 10 years, so then he became a right-winger supporting...
He supported the intervention, and I guess the big thing about Hitchens was... that's why he pissed off a lot of people, but it's also that he...
He's for the Kurds.
He's for us. He's for Western...
Yeah.
The
Western...
What disgusted him was seeing all these people taking the side of Islamofascism over our way of life.
Yeah.
And what he saw that as dangerous, and I think what he did was he chose very, you know, consciously to be that person that defends the Western way.
Against the religious fanatics in any culture. That's what he was against.
Right.
Yeah, as a secular humanist.
Yeah.
Now what?
But he supported the invasion of Iraq, you know.
That's right, yeah.
And Bush, so that's why he's got all the hatred.
That's the second time I saw him. About 2007, a WBAI Black Panther guy who, you know, back in the 60s, Plato Benjamin, he was very pissed off at Christopher Hitchens. So he forced Hitchens to have a debate with him, and it's probably on YouTube. It's interesting. So Plato Benjamin, who's a stutterer, he'd get up there and argue with Hitchens over Iraq, and the world's never met. I mean... Hitchens didn't take all the litany of left disgust at Bush and all that coming out of Plato Benjamin, and Plato Benjamin didn't take anything that Hitchens was saying seriously, so the two didn't meet. And then I spoke to Hitchens after about this and that. He was very much of a populist. He was available. After he'd hang out with anybody and talk to anybody.
Well, he loved talking, didn't he?
Yeah. He wasn't elitist to go up in the green room and then disappear.
Yeah.
So I liked that about him, that he would be there mingling with all the street kids and that and the people after, and other people would have gone home. And then shortly after that, he got ill. And then he was sick for a couple of years, and that's it. So I had two and a half encounters with him, the half being an incomplete phone call.
Yeah.
So you... Did you ever meet him? Did you ever listen?
No, I've never met him.
So does Zizek argue against Hitchens?
I've never heard of him saying anything about him other than to maybe, I don't know if he actually did this, but if he had, it would be to just voice his utter disgust with him.
Either way, they both would be disgusted with the other, right?
I don't think Hitchens, I mean, look, Zizek...
You say Zizek would be disgusted.
Zizek's not a big player. He's a big player among his, but, you know... Hitchens was a writer's writer. I mean, Hitchens was a guy who, you know, writing at politics and things like that and the sensuousness of life and things, that's what appealed to him. Zizek's the kind of guy who thinks that through his words, some kind of action will take place that'll change the change the world and
so you're saying Zizek,
bring about some kind of communism.
Which way was the disgust? Zizek would be disgusted at Hitchens or Hitchens would be disgusted at Zizek? Which way were you saying?
No, I think Zizek would, if anything, be disgusted at Hitchens, and Hitchens would just write Zizek off completely,
right?
Because it wasn't a serious debate with Zizek, you know what I mean? He's just got his political stuff, but it's all theoretical in a way.
Yep, he's trying to talk about the unconscious, which is what we're talking about now.
He's a Lacanian analyst. I mean,
okay. So what would you? I gave you my history of the unconscious. What would you say about the unconscious? What you studied Lacan, is that relevant to our time? The Lacanian unconscious?
No, I mean I think that the relevance of Lacan almost ended. I mean, after cinema became a very commonplace thing, you know.
The mirror self is a product of literacy.
Yeah. I mean, Lacan. I mean, I think Lacan had his ideas because of film and because of this new medium coming out.
Yeah, movies.
Because that was the whole point. I mean, his whole point was the eye and the mother's eye and, like, you know, being in this. And Zizek talks about this too, about, you know, being a being this, you know, the film kind of going into you.
Yeah.
And McLuhan talked about it a little with TV as well.
Well, you know, McLuhan said films were an extension of the foot and eye. TV was an extension of the hand and eye.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Foot is kinetic. Movies, not tactile. But this thing about the whole postmodern enterprise of Foucault and Lacan and who else? Deleuze and Guattari with the thing about schizophrenia and...
Badiou.
Yeah, yeah, and Lyotard and Barthes, They're all French. A lot of them are French. Therefore, they're heavily invested in the Enlightenment and literacy, industrial literacy.
Oh, but Derrida, too.
Derrida, yeah. The Electric Age made them aware of the disservices of the Gutenberg industrial era. So they spent their time analyzing the past and didn't know what McLuhan meant. He would say, Mr. Lacan, you're aware of the mirror aspect of the literate effect because movies and television made you aware of that, and you're unconscious of the new non-mirror self, the analogical mirror self, which is a collective self, a discarnate self.
Yeah.
And so I've done a huge essay on every one of these guys, taking their quotes and then showing how they replayed McLuhan and almost did it incompletely.
Yeah.
Ever seen that huge paper I did?
No.
You might be interested in that. So it gives you ammunition to use McLuhan against every one of them. Because they replay McLuhan's particulars, like in the Gutenberg Galaxy, but they're not as comprehensive as his. And McLuhan is only looking at the 20th century and showing that the Electric Age is a big unconscious phenomenon that no one's noticing. That's why McLuhan was detached about all the developments in art, science, physics, and whatever. Hmm. He said, you guys are just responding to the new unconscious, which is your immediate environment. Your technical environment.
What does it mean to just be responding to something, I wonder?
Not knowing the causes. You are part of the effect. The effect of the Electric Age was to make intellectuals aware of the limitations of the logocentric, literate, Foucault, panopticon, mirror self world. Mm-hmm. They became aware of the previous environment because the new environment made them aware of an older environment.
Right.
And they couldn't see the new environment that was making them see the older environment. So Burroughs is a knee-jerk response to the Electric Age, McLuhan would say. McLuhan was the only one who was comprehensive, not of this era. He could see the service and disservice of other eras in media and see clearly this one, whereas most intellectuals like Zizek or anybody that we know about is filled with some kind of enthusiasm, conscious or unconscious, of effects caused by the electric world.
Mm.
All right? They become ideologues or they become agent provocateurs.
You have to. If you're dealing with things that are incomplete, the only recourse is to become fascist. I mean, the only recourse is to become
fanatic about particular technological bias,
yeah.
Pro or con. Yeah, and that's not what McLuhan was. That's why he said, I don't have a point of view. I'm not a fanatically involved. Now, you could say he became a fanatic Catholic and had to go to the Mass every day to balance off, you know, the 20th century, but we don't need to go into that really as an issue because McLuhan kept it out of his public statements as much as possible.
Yeah.
So you have... You had McLuhan the most attached, and that's why he...
Well, that's also an interesting thing about McLuhan is that, I mean, if there's one thing I can say about him that might be a not so great a thing, was that he didn't always admit his own bias, you know.
Well, he thought he didn't have a bias.
Yeah, see, that's a problem for me, I think.
Okay, now listen, let me answer that immediately. His bias is his chemical body. Being a Catholic was a chemical body action. He knew that was puny. He said, any of my gestures are puny compared to the environment we're up against. I just want other people to notice the environment and the futility of our chemical body reactions. To the point in his later life, he said being a Catholic is obsolete. Going to the Mass may not solve this issue. And so he even questioned with the power of the discarnate. He says, we cannot be a Catholic anymore because there's no ground for the literate basis of Catholicism. It's not there anymore. So he even recognized that. So then he was sort of, I don't know what you would say he was. He was ironic and manipulative and trying to get other Catholics to notice this issue and maybe bring in media ecology and turn off the TV environment. But he also knew there was a drift going on and people weren't going to do it. So I have letters that he wrote to his daughter, Mary, personal letters, where he said, we're probably going to have a nuclear war next week. He says, he's saying, it's so out of control right now that you can expect any disastrous thing to happen. Because the managers have no clue what they're up against, and something can blow up immediately. So, not that he would say, he was telling his daughter that for some reason. She was getting divorced, so he was trying to get her to think differently about her situation. He was against the divorce. So his letter was quite a panicking situation. But I don't think that was where he is all the time, just in relation to her. He's trying to get her to wake up to a larger... non-selfish view of things. So
it's funny. I just saw some comedian talking about his religious beliefs. He's basically like, when it comes to my own daughter, I am the most right-wing,
yeah,
conservative Christian, you know,
fundamentalist, yeah,
possible.
Yeah.
When it comes to your daughter, on the other hand,
I'm
the most liberal, moralist.
Right.
person on the planet.
Now, that's someone showing the quadrophenia of the average citizen trying to live these different media realities in different bodies. He's expressing that in simple comedic terms.
Yeah.
You know, he's admitting, I got two selves.
Yeah, well, I brought it up just because it's funny, because McLuhan, I don't know how much you can take into... But
okay, about his bias. He was not trying to be biased in his public talk. He tried to keep himself as much as possible. I mean, there's a limitation just because you got to use words to talk to people, and that evokes the chemical body world.
Yeah, well, and I think that... I mean, I'm not saying that it's really a bad thing. I'm just saying that there's one thing that...
Well, you
might bother
be...
me or others about him is that he, you know, he didn't like to be pinned down.
No, he...
He was
saying that you can't pin him down. He'd like you to pin him down, but you can't because electric conditions, there's no point to really stop
him. No, I just mean he was a very slippery character. You know,
right.
he couldn't really say, well, you're only saying that because... I mean, people tried with being saying, okay, yeah, you were a media determinist.
Yeah,
That's the only challenge leveled at him besides, you know, the oracular sort of... thing, saying you're just the kind of a Delphic oracle.
He would
riddles and
he would he was always trying to show how the orality of his mouth. The orality of his mouth could be temporary any environment to these categorizations. Then he was pointing how the electric tactile environment made it even worse for you trying to categorize. So the slipperiness was not to hide what he was. His bias was to show you the slipperiness of a speech medium.
Sure, absolutely.
And then saying was extended by tactility and be more slippery.
Yeah.
So, okay, what we're saying. So I see McLuhan, he has the law of those characters of the 6, 7, 8, he has the longest lifespan because his stuff is deeper than the others. I mean,
but it also can be applied to a whole lot of things.
Yeah.
To his credit, I mean, it's because he focused on what he focused on, which was the medium, not the message, not the content.
Yeah, and he wasn't political. He wasn't ideological.
And that gives you staying power.
It's
pretty easy to see that.
And it's kind of like he's a mythic poet. He was a poet.
Well, like I said, Delphic Oracle. I mean, you know.
Yeah, an oracle would be... His vision was so wide because he referred to post-verbal landscapes that people projected the huge depth of the post-verbal environment back on him and called him an oracle, which he would just frown at, you know.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, the projections on him, those show cultural biases themselves.
Yeah, of course.
Or media biases. So we got here...
You've heard the phrase by, or the sentence by Emerson, one of my favorites. It's that people don't seem to realize that their opinion of the world is also a confession of character.
Yeah, that's a good quote.
And I think that applies to people as well. You know, obviously, their opinion of other people really says more about themselves than anybody else.
Yeah, someone said...
People can be anybody they want.
Yeah, someone said literary criticism is always autobiographical.
Yeah.
And McLuhan would point that out, that he'd say, Eliot, you see, look at what Eliot's writing about. You'll see he's working out his poetic concerns, his concerns for his poetry. And so McLuhan, being aware of that, was trying not to have... that kind of personal bias. Yes, he wasn't doing anything. He wasn't a poet. He wasn't a singer. He had no thing to defend. But that was an advantage state to be in or position. And there was another thought there. He considered himself a playwright, and he was trying to present the media and his actors.
Eliot.
No, McLuhan. The art form he wanted, he was frustrated not getting done, was a Broadway musical.
Yeah, I was surprised to learn from the Aphelion essay that he had actually written a play.
Well, yeah, he did twice. He did in the 50s.
I had no idea.
Yeah, well, there's a lot about McLuhan. Unless you go to the archives and go through it all, he's like a Renaissance man. Hmm. You know, a lot of materials you're not aware of. And he did a play, an update in the 70s. He did two versions of it.
And it's strange that he never had a TV show that took off, you know.
Well, look, back then...
People were finicky about it.
No, but look at this. Back then, there's only a certain number of space on the analog
true.
Media.
Yeah,
it was all political.
Right.
And McLuhan was seen as a radical guy of the 60s.
Yeah.
And in the 70s, the Kissingers were getting nervous. So they said, let's put a Carl Sagan on with billions and billions of stars in the cosmos. Or Northrop Frye in Canada. Northrop Frye got picked to do the special.
Really?
Yeah, he analyzed the Canadian nature. He says, we're a nation of accountants.
Huh.
Now, McLuhan wouldn't talk that small if he had gotten on there. And that was his last project, was having a TV show in L.A., but he had a stroke in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And the guy who he was doing with lives here on Maui, David Greenberg.
Huh.
Yeah, he's been coming here since 69. He did a book called The Tree Houses of Hawaii. He's involved in the bamboo industry. And he criticizes this whole stretch of tourism as ego-tourism.
E-G-O.
Ego-tourism. And he's for eco-tourism. Yeah. He tries to offer eco-tourism on the rainy side of Maui.
That's a funny thing, eco-tourism.
Ego tourism.
No, I know, but that is too. But ecotourism itself is pretty hilarious.
That's people running around for the old obsolete nature, and that Sputnik retrieved. See, the image of nature was created by the phonetic alphabet. Then the printing press killed and consumed nature, and we call that science and industry. And then nature, that image of nature, comes back in the ecological era of Earth Day, and that's a rearview mirror response. The real nature that we want to program is the electronic media. That's the nature, the new nature, not the old nature that was caused by the phonetic alphabet. So we're talking about Zizek, Foucault, McLuhan. So McLuhan even wrote that the bias of the 20th century is to notice the bias of media. The very thing that he was known for, he called that bias. That's how unbiased he was trying to be. He was saying that what the general knowledge that he was putting out that people thought, oh, we learned from McLuhan, the medium is the message. He was saying it's natural in the 20th century to notice that the medium is the message. And then he's saying the 20th century and its medium makes you notice that the medium is the message.
Yeah, he did position himself as sort of the spokesperson for what was going on.
Right, but he was trying to point out that even he didn't identify with the concept the medium is the message. He says, you will think that is what you're learning from me, but you won't hear me tell you that the 20th century makes you notice that the medium is the message, because there's so many media environments that eventually start to notice a few of them, and you say, wow, we were conditioned by those. And that's what postmodernism. Postmodernism, as you got in the schools in the 80s and 90s, is all watered-down, fucked-up McLuhanism, and they don't know it.
It's cherry-picking.
Right, and the only one who knew it was Arthur Croker. And that's why he was the best postmodernist, and how he pushed it beyond Baudrillard.
That's why his website looks like something from the 90s.
Yeah, he's a 90s guy. I mean, I'm the guy who's the most advanced now. If you look on the chart, you know, I come after the Croker quadrant. You got the LaRouche quadrant, which would be the Christopher Hitchens, Noam Chomsky, Norman Mailer world is the LaRouche quadrant. Then McLuhan goes past that. He's later. And then William Ernst Thompson is a different quadrant. And that's the New Age and the post-Sputnik world, the ecological fanaticism, the nature world, which wasn't interested in McLuhan. And then you have Croker's...
What would McLuhan see as the most crucial... crucial...
Perceptor? Me. He'd see
the
me.
The most crucial craft in this
me.
Day and age.
Me.
The most crucial...
Me. He said it.
I'm down with you. I don't care about
you. No. See, you don't want to know the president. I'm telling you. He has told me through the Evergreens. He's told me through other means. And Don Field told me. It's what I do is the hidden artist of our time, scientist. Okay? Now, I don't care if
what you do is discourse.
No, I don't. And that's with you. I got to use words. What? You don't know what I'm doing when I'm not discoursing.
No.
I used to run the Secret Council of 10. Okay? Which you, of course, Nicaragua. I'm in the same position. I know exactly how McLuhan, when he would talk about the meaning of the message in the 60s, people would snicker and go, are you nuts, Marshall? That's crazy. You're a technological determinist. And they couldn't understand what it is. So I get labeled as a megalomaniac, whatever, cartoon, and I know that's not what I'm doing, that I'm doing other stuff that's not aware of.
Yeah,
so,
but there must be, like, you know,
okay,
if you something that can be done that if your name's not Bob.
There's not much you can do. Okay, so you're asking me. I'll try to take another tack. You don't like that response? I'll give you another response.
That's all I want.
Yeah, you want a different response. Okay. You're asking what would McLuhan say?
Yeah, no, I mean, just but in all seriousness, like, what discipline did he see as going to be important in this? In
media ecology.
Media ecology, yeah.
Yeah. And who was doing it before anybody else was doing it? Me, on the radio, in a public format, in the 80s. There was nobody else doing it. I mean, Neil Postman had a course at the CUNY, you know,
yeah.
A little puny, a few people,
right.
And they didn't understand media ecology. Eric McLuhan doesn't identify with Postman's media ecology. So who else? Nobody.
Levinson went to that program.
Yeah, Levinson is damaged by the Postman world.
Yeah.
Did you listen to my debate with or discussion?
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, some people think that Levinson, well, the stupid people think that Levinson did well against me. I thought he was trivial. He didn't even begin to address the issue.
I mean, I didn't see it as... I thought he was just more level-headed.
Level-headed. See, there you are projecting. I am level-headed. Paul isn't. Paul can't stop promoting himself and yelling and screaming about it. I did this.
Paul can't stop promoting himself.
Yeah. I had nothing to promote, but he does. You see, at the very beginning...
I didn't hear him promoting himself.
Okay, because you didn't pay attention. The first question was... Hey, Paul, give us a few books you wrote. He spent 5 minutes listing his whole itinerary. Every book he has, 25 books. He listed every one of them.
You asked him.
No, I said, give us a couple books you wrote. He said, okay, I'll give you all of them. And I didn't interrupt him. I let him hang his own self by his own pretender. He spent 5 minutes listening to every book. It's ridiculous.
I think that's fine. I think it established him, you asked for it.
No, I said a couple of books. That's what I said. He didn't take me because he's a self-promoter.
Well, he wanted to show that he had a...
Yeah, he's a self-promoter. He wanted to think that he did a lot of crap. He did a lot of crap. It's just crap what he does.
What would have been a good answer in Bob's view?
He would have said two books, his latest and maybe his first one, and then said he did the conference with McLuhan in 1978 and got the tetrads because Postman didn't understand. And that's it. Now we'll get into the present. Because the audience for Paul is already known. The people who would listen to me already know of Paul generally.
Yeah.
Now, other people, they all went to sleep when he listened to this book. I mean, that's illiterate. He's such a P.O.B., old-fashioned P.O.B. disguised as a radio DJ, okay? And his responses are terrible in relation to presenting some kind of any environment to...
What was his reaction to that exchange, that being on the...
Oh, he all the way through, he says, I agree, Bob, I completely agree.
He took some issues with certain things.
Oh, later, and then I pointed out how those limited his view was, and he couldn't even understand my criticism. I was using McLuhan on him, and he didn't even recognize it, so I wasn't going to go over and over it, just let those historians in the future recognize the limitations. So but for the average person, it was a nice little argument, discussion, whatever. It was actually seemed quite friendly. But me and Andrew were probably thinking, what a dummy this guy is, which we already did think that. I mean, up until now, Paul, you're a dummy, and you haven't got the guts to call me up and find out some more details. Too busy promoting your latest book, which he does on the Media Calls You List. You're not on the Media Calls You List. Sorry, it's ridiculous. Even Mark Stallman, that loser in terms of McLuhan studies, he says, wow, Paul did a good job against Bob. Paul, who were used to his flagrant self-promotion, this is what Mark says about Paul, even though he was self-promoting himself, he still came up with some good points and a bunch of blah, blah that had mean nothing. You got to wait around to understand my argument. You got to listen for a while.
It's different, though. I mean, the point was, to me, I mean, these mom conferences, I think that it was one of the more honest ones.
Oh, it's the best thing going.
Because it was an exploration of who McLuhan was,
with real knowledge.
Yeah, and remembering the man.
I'm not knocking the McLuhan conference and who participated, but the conference would not have had the energy and ongoing 5-hour performance without me. I'm the one who brought in the ideas that kept it going. I was the motor, but I allowed other people to say a bit, and I appreciate their contributions. But basically, the McLuhan of Maui is my incredible mouth output. Buzz Kosten's incredible video output, Andrew's incredible Twitter output, and Dark Matter's incredible design output. You got four aspects, and then we had Ion. Ion's incredible metaphysical output. Five aspects, a pentad, that killed any other McLuhan thing that went on this year. It made it ridiculous. We're so huge and important, the others don't even recognize us. They don't know how to categorize us. We're beyond, like McLuhan. He's the key arguer in the 60s, and nobody knows what he's saying. They don't even know how to include him. Tim Leary didn't know that, and I discussed this with Tim Leary. I even discussed it after Tim died. But when he was alive, you can go on my timeline and watch me with Tim Leary in Tim Leary's home doing a TV show. Do you know about that?
No.
You don't know about it. And you watch him, he's trying to promote McLuhan. So before the recording, I knew he was going to do that. And I said, why are you promoting McLuhan now when you didn't understand him in the 60s, 70s? But you see, I admit I didn't understand him. It's just that with this computer world, it's sort of obvious the relevance of McLuhan now, and I just want people to know about it. So he's a belated McLuhanite, but in the interview, which is with me and Nelson Thal and him for a TV show in L.A., he got so freaked out by what we're saying, he ran out of the room. He left the middle of the recording. We had to bring him back, and you see him at the end. He's holding the mic. We don't have time to put it back on the thing, and he's in a total panic state. So then he dies a couple years later. So I ask him, through the evergreens, when he's dead, why did he run out of the room? He says, I just got exhausted by you guys. I couldn't keep up. He says it right there. Now, I didn't tell him to say that. The evergreens are who he's coming through, Michael Blake Reed and the evergreens. So I can tell you incredible stuff about all this stuff if you had the time to hear it all. Now, I don't expect you to have the time. So if you want to understand why I consider Paul Levinson a flake, and what he does, and would tell him to his face. I try to be more polite in the mum thing, because it's not just me there, but I don't have a problem telling him. As a matter of fact, there is this journal called Figure and Ground. You know about that.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, Raman Lanyon, he's got an odd name. He may be Brazilian or Argentinian. he's interviewing everybody. Eric, Lance Straight, all the media colleges and other, and it's a pretty good site for interviews. Well, he's supposedly going to interview.
Oh, is it figureground.canada?
Yeah.
I have seen that.
Yeah.
Nice, yeah.
Right. So he's interviewing all these people. Well, he's going to do me and Andrew at some point, he said.
Oh, nice.
So I'm going to go on there, and I'm going to go through, I'm going to review all, everybody who's on there. I'm going to pin the donkey, the tail, on every one of their donkey contributions. I'm going to go through and correct every one of them. Now, people may not understand my corrections, but I'm going to do it because the students are being deprived of a real education. Who's ever in the media college, they do not get what's really going on. You're getting a bit of it from just engaging with us. And you, of course, know that your fellow students at New School won't even know about this. They won't even know what you've learned. But we offer the real stuff, and you're not going to get it in any university course because we know so much, especially me. I know the whole history of the whole thing because I actually was the guy who helped make McLuhan famous. Now, think of that. They think it's Tom Wolfe. It was Clay Felker at the International Herald Tribune, whatever the weekend stuff it was. He hired Tom Wolfe to write an article on him, and that was under my influence because I knew Clay Felker.
Okay.
Look up Clay Felker. He ended up being a professor at Columbia. He was a famous journalist, editor guy in New York. So I'm not doing this to beat you over the head. I'm just putting it on the record. So when someone hears this 1,000 years from now, then they can check out my timeline and hear all the stuff.
Data trash, man.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not going to be around in 1,000 years or 10 years.
Oh, with the way I'm going, it's going to be around. I'll make sure it's around.
We'll see.
Since I ain't dying, I can keep it going.
Yeah.
So what about this? If we take the laws of media and look at the tetrads, did we do the tetrad on tactile space?
No.
Last time or one of the first sessions? Tactile space 142. This is really interesting. This explains postmodernism. Look at this. Tactile space enhances upbeat interval, what you call dead air, right? Enhances upbeat interval and play. Obsolesces the connected. That's visual space. Derek Kirchhoff says that the internet brings in connected space. That's bullshit. It includes connected, but it also includes the disconnected. It oscillates. The internet is tactilely squared, not mechanical connected squared.
Can you explain a little bit about what you mean by squared and why you use it?
It's the media simulation, so that the book squares the eye space. And electricity is the radio and TV, that's the extension of tactility. To square that, to create an environment that goes around it, you use digital technology. So basically, the digital squares analog media, means puts a bracket around it, or goes around it and subsumes it. That's how I, that's what I mean by squared. So then it retrieves the common sense. That's Thomas Aquinas' view, medieval view of the common sense is tactility, which is the meeting place of all the senses. Not the senses per se, but the meeting interplay place.
This is what it retrieves.
Yeah, that's tactility. So the tactile space retrieves that concept from Thomas Aquinas.
Play.
Yeah. And, well, play, I guess play,
that's,
yeah,
that's where,
I
that's
think, yeah, it's not, yeah, play is not. So, upbeat interval is extended. Play is not part of that. Okay, so upbeat interval is extended. The connected is obsolesced. Retrieved is play, or the common sense, the meeting place of all senses. And it flips into the uptight, think of Zizek, the kinetic, he froze. The kinetic space is what neoconservatism is. Visual values, where the content, after you flip, you see a tactile space and you push it to extreme in the 60s in the global theater, it flips into its opposite. It flips into the uptight and kinetic space. And the kinetic space is the values that Reagan represented, the values of visual, industrial, neo-Americanism.
We have to do something?
Yeah, no, we have to save America. We have to revitalize it. We must get over the grief that happened in the 60s.
You do that by just keeping moving.
Keep
on going.
And keeping the dances going, keep the rock and roll music and movies going.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's kind of it's a very tribal idea, right?
Yeah.
You got to keep the sun revolving, so you got to dance in order to do that as they're dancing and beating their drums over there.
Right, that's right. So the kinetic is the collective, the aspect of the multi-collective unconscious that's retrieved by America. And also, it's let's move forward with digital technology so that our discarnate selves are moving in more unique private spaces. It's a discarnate kineticism. So that's a very profound tetrad that you've got here. And The characteristics of the 80s and 90s is a retrieved kinetic space squared. That, and no one else will tell you that. No one, you've never heard anybody analyze this in public. You don't hear Lance Strait or Paul Evanson analyze the
tetrahedron.
Okay,
okay.
Yeah, okay. No,
I know,
I'm complaining.
I know I'm getting a unique
I hope you will.
Experience here. We've already established
you're getting
that.
The only experience.
2 weeks ago we already established that I'm getting a unique experience.
Okay, rub it in. Okay, you want to grab another I just think that's...
Well, actually, this is the 2-week anniversary of the first meeting.
You've been here 2 weeks? What day did you come?
On a Saturday night.
So this is Saturday?
Oh, okay, so yeah, right.
That's a
so
week
we
ago.
Met tomorrow, a week ago
no,
tomorrow.
One week.
2 weeks ago tomorrow.
You're kidding, 2 weeks?
2 weeks.
What was the day you came?
It was a Saturday night.
So today is the 17th, so it was the 3rd. 3 and 7 is 10, 17. Well, wow, it just seems that you were just here last week. So how come we only had 4 meetings in 2 weeks?
Well, we met more often than that. I think we met 6 times, but
okay.
We only record 4.
All right, so...
Those were off the record because it was such a paper that could not be contained by the recording.
Yeah. So, okay, so you've been here for 2 weeks. Yeah, I knew you were going to be over 2 weeks.
17 days total. Yeah.
Right. Okay, is there, what's the time? How are we doing? Is that an hour and 15 minutes?
It's 40 on the
second half. And the other is 30, so that's 40. Maybe the other one's 40, so that's an hour and a half. That's good. That's our limit.
All right.
So we end with the Great Tetrad on page 142.
And Zizek as the reversal, as a product of
let's do
space.
Let's do a tetrad on Hitchens and Zizek, all right? But did you stop the recording?
No.
Okay, so what does Hitchens enhance?
I know he'll retrieve the whole Norman Mailer, the
journalistic contrariness. I mean, he was a lefty in the 70s.
Does he enhance that?
Yeah.
No, retrieves the sort of the prosaic, you know.
Okay,
prose.
Let's do enhancing first. What does he enhance? He enhances the myth of the American writer. Okay,
he's not American.
No, but he becomes a figure in American media.
I don't know. I think I would have to say for him, it occurs to me that he enhances self-contained contradiction.
Okay,
in a way,
right. Yeah.
Because he's taken all sides of every issue.
That's the schizophrenia of literacy. He enacts out the writer meme.
But he does it well. He doesn't do it out of reaction. He does it because he really, I assume, and everybody else assumes, and it seems to be the case, that he does it because things aren't cut and dry. Things don't line up neatly along.
Right. So that's what the poet...
And he enriches each position that he takes.
Right. Now, that's what the poet would do. The Kluhn would say in the Gutenberg era, where science became the model, which was trying to reduce everything to a simple level of meaning and precision, mathematical precision, the poet would bring in the ambiguity and the resulting ambivalence of language. That was the poet's role, basically.
So that seems like the opposite of what Hitchens did.
No, he brought in ambivalence, showing the contradictions of whatever simplified issues the TV landscape presented.
No, he embodied the contradictions.
That's what I mean.
Of, you know,
well,
because you know, he was far left at one point, and then he was far right at the other,
mm-hmm.
but he was neither in both at the same time. And
that's so right. He was a media dandy. He was...
Yeah, that's
so he enhanced the media dandy.
Right.
Okay? He obsolesced what? What did he obsolesce?
Let me think. I don't know. It's tough.
He obsolesced everybody he debated. He obsolesced Mother Teresa.
But what does Mother Teresa represent? You don't just obsolesce
religiosity. He tried to. He didn't obsolesce religiosity, but he was. He obsolesced.
What's the stance toward religiosity?
Atheism.
No, not his stance. The stance that he.
Was
he
against.
Was trying to destroy. Or
he obsolesced religionism. Well, what's that? Religionist. That's what McCune calls it, taking the religionist.
Huh.
Yeah, and then
what does that entail?
Someone who's involved with manuscript culture and religion, either the Bible, the Quran, or Buddhism. Manuscript stuff.
I still think we're not getting to the heart of what...
He didn't obsolesce anything, is the point. He was a figure in the ground.
Well, but his image must have obsolesced, since it's a medium.
Yeah, well, okay, his image obsolesced
the image of him,
the clean Puritan writer, because he was the alcoholic, celebrated drinking and carousing.
Okay.
So he, in a way, he retrieved Norman Mailer.
He retrieved the whole Great Gatsby, '30s British journalist.
Fitzgerald guy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. The drunk, drinking, celebrating writer.
Yeah.
And that's sort of like Norman Mailer, but that's what he retrieved. He obsolesced the dogmatic journalist. Because he was subject to change.
Because he was so calm. Yeah, exactly.
And
that's
changed.
Right.
Yeah. He lived in the moment or responded to changing conditions. So he was not... He obsolesced the ideological journalist.
Maybe, in a way, he obsolesced understanding in a very interesting way. Because what he did was overstand, or what's the one you...
Overlay.
Overlay.
Yeah.
That stuff. And he did it with such panache, you know, that...
yeah, I think he obsolesced...
Probably understanding is one of the things... political understandings,
right.
He obsolesced, you know, by just being so able and so skilled.
He obsolesced the dogmatic partisan journalist.
Yeah.
He was partisan, but he's quadriphenic ultimately and shifted where
totally,
he'd be
yeah.
Partisan about. Okay, so push your stream, what did he slip into? What was the disservice or characteristic he slipped into?
Dead.
Probably dead and forgotten.
I don't know about that. So he flipped into... depending on what killed
why
him.
Must, why, well,
a suicide. He flipped into a suicide. All deaths are a suicide, says Ion.
Yeah.
So he killed himself.
The thing is, well, he did. I mean, in a very real way, he knew that...
Yeah.
Because his father died from the same exact thing. And when he was diagnosed with esophageal cancer, esophageal cancer,
yeah.
Whatever it is,
his
first reaction, he said on an interview, was, just basically, la, that's it. This is the most... the least interesting way to die. It's just so blasé.
To die. So he wasn't going
to
die.
To die of this, this cancer that my father died from, that I knew my whole life that I was going to probably die from. And
so he refused to die that bland.
And he lit a cigarette.
What?
And he lit a cigarette.
Yeah, yeah. He was not going to keep up. He was not going to adjust to it.
Yep.
Okay, so now Zizek. What does Zizek enhance? The concerns.
Zizek enhances the monk's the studious cave in the cave sort of thing.
Yeah.
Coming in emerging from the cave with this tablet of insight.
The artist has a garret. Ivory Tower artist who's off developing his art in the attic, and then he comes public. So that old critical division of Ruskin or Matthew Arnold, some probably Columbia guy, Lionel Trilling, they're guys who stayed off by themselves and developed their theory and then came forward with it.
Fuck, even Leary was like that.
Yeah, yeah, Tim Leary, yeah. Okay, so so that's partly a retrieval. So he enhanced the updated left, or he enhanced the left because he was the left that finally dealt with the simulacrum, even though Baudrillard did it and nobody understood it. He seems to be... redoing Baudrillard where it's more understandable by the population. So what is he enhancing?
No, actually, I think it's less on... I mean, the population, nobody really... people know Baudrillard's ideas a lot better
than
they would Zizek's.
Okay.
Zizek is... I mean, he really... He has a book called Tarrying with the Negative. I mean, he really gets into things and really gets into concepts and all around them and into them. I mean,
that
he really goes deep.
That the population wouldn't do.
The population just doesn't have the
the Baudrillard was surface enough.
Wherewithal to
do. Baudrillard did not do that.
No, Baudrillard was on surface, you know.
Yeah.
He was skipping, he was like a skipping stone. I mean, he was just all over the surface and
yeah.
He tried to do what McLuhan did. I mean,
yeah.
I think he, in a way, Baudrillard, I don't know if he'd ever admitted, I know that he did admit that McLuhan was a huge influence on him, but he never really admitted in what way. And I think that, you know, if you read his cool memories about America and things like that, that's what he's doing. He's just gathering these impressions,
yeah.
You know. And he's trying to be another McLuhan by pretending to be, have these profound, impressions that serve as in the place of insight.
Right. This is how you look at my chart. I've got the basic analog media quadrants, and then the Android meme wholly opacically replays them. So who replays LaRouche? Rush Limbaugh. Who replays McLuhan? Baudrillard. Who replays wholly opacically William Irwin Thompson? Terence McKenna. Who replays Croker? No, I'm just thinking of any of your digital guys, and you know, disinfo.com, Richard, whatever his name is. They, it would have to be an environment that redoes Croker because he's a cyborg, So there's somebody on the net, there's probably been a lot of them, that are popular for a while. And even someone could say, I replay. Yeah, Rush, no, he's a replay of McLuhan.
Yeah.
You know, in a tiny way. And who's a replay of me? Who's a replay of me?
To be continued.
No. There's all kinds of imitators of me. Okay, so that's Church of the Subgenius. They redo me. Okay, back to Zizek. So he's a homeopathic replay of Baudrillard?
Zizek?
Yeah.
No, they're contemporaries. You know.
Well, what's he a homeopathic replay of?
I don't know.
Or what's he enhanced? Did you decide what he enhances?
Yeah, you said it, didn't you? Did you say, what was it? Yeah, like the artist.
Oh, the artist power could Matthew Arnold. Or who's one of those, Gramsci. Antonio Gramsci.
There you go. Okay, yeah, right. From the prison.
And he actually did a beginning of the simulation analysis. Gramsci was
noticing
that. So then he obsolesces, who is the obsolesce? Noam Chomsky? Maybe Noam Chomsky? He's probably more popular than Noam Chomsky now.
Now, if you surround something, do you obsolesce it, basically?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that would hold then.
Okay.
Noam Chomsky.
And he retrieves Baudrillard. What does he retrieve? Well, that's Matthew Arnold last.
Well, yeah, like the monks. The monks in the caves.
The literary
studious,
person.
The very studious, like, you know.
The writer.
Yeah,
the writer. And
but there's another sense in that, I mean, he obviously replays Lacan.
Yeah.
He was a student of Lacan, so.
Well, but Lacan didn't write. He just spoke and they taped his or wrote notes.
A lot of that, yeah. But
yeah. So he's he is right. He is a retrieval of the writer. So then he pushes into, flips into his extreme. What's the opposite of him that he's slipping into? A TV show. He flips into a TV show
because he's right. Marrying a supermodel, a Brazilian supermodel.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. He married a Brazilian supermodel whose father was a Marxist intellectual.
And
that's the thing.
A Brazilian one. And this when? Recently?
Past 6 years. 7 years.
So what does she do? Is she just behind?
She's a supermodel.
Oh, she continues.
Yeah.
So he flips into the simulacrum that he was trying to critique.
He flips into celebrity.
Yeah, the TV, the non-literary role, the post-literary role.
Yeah.
Because fashion is...
Which is obviously not, I mean, not comfortable. It's not the best place for him since all the stuttering and...
Yeah.
And all the weird, the way he looks is so stark.
Yeah, he's not slick enough. He's not glamorous enough. So...
No, it's very brute.
Yep. He's a monk. He's like a crummy monk in the court.
Doesn't know how to communicate.
But fashion...
It's funny. I do have a thing. I was going to go to this thing, to this talk, and a bunch of my friends ended up going, and they told me he was there in New York, and it was him and Badiou.
Yeah.
And somebody had an issue with one of Zizek's ideas, and so this student stood up, you know, at the end, and asked this question, you know, just saying... You know, I don't know if I really agree with you on this thing. Zizek wouldn't even entertain this question.
He
said,
ignored him.
Who the hell are you? He said, you are nothing but a... He said something like, you're nothing but an obsolesce ant or some shit. Like, he just gave this weird intellectual,
dismissal
of him. And it was really a pissed off one, too. You know, he was just really angered that anybody would dare question... Anything.
Well,
you know, that's just what my friends were saying about it.
That's a dogmatic literary response.
Yeah.
I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, how dare you? Who are you?
Yeah.
Basically kind of
say some words that we don't recognize.
Yeah.
We're just saying that. But I was going to just end up saying fashion itself, the popularity of fashion in the 80s and 90s, that is so kinetic space.
But in a way...
Follow this. The kinetic space is indicated by the models walking down the catwalk, or whatever they call that thing they walk on. The models were kinetic space. Glamorous, instant, moving, flashy. That's what tactility flipped into. And models were the...
That's why Zizek married a model.
Yeah, he married the simulation.
He married the graceful reversal.
He became what he beheld. That's what he did. That's the name of Carpenter's book. And McLuhan used it, and that's the Catholic version.
One last thing, I think it's switching gears a bit, but I really want to know a little bit more about this whole idea of what is it? Oh, what a blow that phantom gave me! I don't know why, but that phrase always sticks out of my.
You know where it's from?
Yeah, it's from a little like pamphlet style book, isn't that?
Yeah,
online.
But no, you don't know what he's quoting. That's Don Quixote in Cervantes.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, so Don Quixote recognizes as a character that he's been running around, you know, rear view mirroring and attacking the past, and in response to the new printing press products. And so he was seduced by a phantom. Oh, what a blow that phantom gave me. The phantom was what he thought communism was. Or in the 20th century, the specter of communism that Senator McCarthy went after in the 50s, okay, he could say that. Oh, what a blow that phantom gave me. He ended up being a disgrace, right? Because he went after a phantom. And Don Quixote did that. He went after trying to retrieve the medieval windmill. Remember he started riding his horses and trying to spear windmills?
Mm-hmm.
He was attacking the new environment, but he was rear-view mirroring it, trying to preserve the past. So that's a phantom. And McLuhan uses that phrase in The War and Peace of Global Village, that idea of the phantom pain of the amputee has a phantom pain.
Yeah.
Well, most of McCarthyism, or most of the cultural content, is a rearview mirror phantom pain that's bugging you, and you don't know why it's not there as a real factor anymore. It's something else that's making you, that's amputated you. So you don't know the hidden new ground that's amputated you. So that's what Carpenter's talking about, how when white man and his technologies came into the New Guinea, Papua New Guinea tribes,
right. They're
running around reacting and looking at a phantom, or thinking it's a phantom. Or the thing they're thinking, the thing they think they're up against is actually a phantom, but they think it's real.
Okay.
Oh, what a blow that phantom gave me. That's a McLuhan statement. Remember, McLuhan...
It's got such a ring to it, doesn't it?
Yeah. And McLuhan... No, he didn't help write that book. He wrote They Became What They Beheld with Carpenter.
Mm-hmm.
Then they had a falling out, so Carpenter dropped McLuhan's name off, but he does give McLuhan a little acknowledgement in the beginning. And then Oh, What a Blow the Phantom Gave Me continues They Became What They Beheld, so still had the McLuhan influence. But that's the book that Carpenter did himself. So
that's what I'll be saying on the plane ride back to New York. Oh, What a Blow that Phantom Gave Me.
Yeah, I think it's actually happening in your private life, too.
And on that note,
yeah.
Thank you very much. This is a great paper. I appreciate
good paper,
you letting
Marty.
Me
awesome paper.
Appreciate you
just
letting
co-wrote
me
it.
Aloha, I'm Mike.